welcome back. I'm Brian, your host, and welcome to episode 14 of the Daily Buddhism. As always, past episodes and show notes are available at www.dailybuddhism.com. Be sure to sign up for the daily email list while you're there, because not everything always makes it to the podcast. Before we get started, I have a few announcements. As I do a quick mental inventory, I'm thinking that we've covered most of what I would consider essential basic Buddhism. It may be just about time to start covering more intermediate-type topics. But before we start that, I want to make sure we covered all the basics. So this time, I'm going to put out another call for your questions. Have I missed a subject that interests you? Is there any topic that I've covered that's unclear or maybe a little too shallow? Do you have questions on anything at all? Do you have any inspiring stories or personal insights you'd like to share? I'm hoping to get enough reader and listener questions and calls for topic elaboration to cover the rest of July, and then start the Daily Buddhism Book 2 in August. When we do more advanced topics, what would you like to see? Let me know. I'm at dailybuddhism@gmail.com. And once again, I probably need to mention that on the Daily Buddhism website, there's a button labeled Donate. Buddhists around the world have survived for 2,500 years on donations and gifts from others. And who am I to break that tradition? If you've enjoyed the emails and podcasts so far, or if you've learned a good bit, please drop something in the box. And that would be appreciated. Okay, so now on with the show. I've got a mixed lot of topics this time, so we're going to be all over the place subject-wise. Let's start with a classic koan story, Finding a Diamond on a Muddy Road. Gudo was the emperor's teacher of his time. Nevertheless, he used to travel alone as a wandering mendicant. Once when he was on his way to Edo, the cultural and political center of the shogunate, he approached a little village named Takenaka. It was evening, and a heavy rain was falling. Gudo was thoroughly wet. His straw sandals were in pieces. At a farmhouse near the village, he noticed four or five pairs of sandals in the window and decided to buy some dry ones. The woman who offered him the sandals, seeing how wet he was, invited him in to remain for the night in her home. Gudo accepted, thanking her. He entered and recited a sutra before the family shrine. He was then introduced to the woman's mother and to her children. Observing that the entire family was depressed, Gudo asked what was wrong. "My husband is a gambler and a drunkard," the housewife told him. "When he happens to win, he drinks and becomes abusive. When he loses, he borrows money from others. Sometimes, when he becomes thoroughly drunk, he doesn't come home at all. What can I do?" "I will help him," said Gudo. "Here is some money. Get me a gallon of fine wine and something good to eat. Then you may retire. I will meditate before the shrine." When the man of the house returned about midnight, quite drunk, he bellowed, "Hey, wife, I'm home. Have you something for me to eat?" "I have something for you," said Gudo. "I happened to be caught in the rain, and your wife kindly asked me to remain here for the night. In return, I have bought some wine and fish, so you might as well have them." The man was delighted. He drank the wine at once and laid himself down on the floor. Gudo sat in meditation beside him. In the morning, when the husband awoke, he had forgotten about the previous night. "Who are you? Where do you come from?" he asked Gudo, who was still meditating. "I am Gudo of Kyoto, and I am going on to Edo," replied the Zen master. The man was utterly ashamed. He apologized profusely to the teacher of his emperor. Gudo smiled. "Everything in this life is impermanent," he explained. "Life is very brief. If you keep on gambling and drinking, you'll have no time left to accomplish anything else, and you'll cause your family to suffer too." The perception of the husband awoke as if from a dream. "You're right," he declared. "How can I ever repay you for this wonderful teaching? Let me see you off and carry your things a little way." "If you wish," assented Gudo. The two started out. After they had gone 3 miles, Gudo told him to return. "Just another 5 miles," he begged Gudo. They continued on. "You may return now," suggested Gudo. after another 10 miles, the man replied. Return now, said Gudo, when the 10 miles had been passed. I am going to follow you all the rest of my life, declared the man. Modern Zen teachings in Japan spring from the lineage of a famous master who was the successor of Gudo. His name was Munan, the man who never turned back. And now we have a reader question. A reader recently wrote to me. A friend of mine recently killed herself. My friend, raised in a Christian environment, knows from what she has been taught that people who commit suicide wind up in the worst part of hell. What is the Buddhist perspective on suicide? And my response. Suicide is bad, no matter what perspective you have. Now, Buddhists do not have a hell, or at least not in the same way Christians do, but that doesn't mean there aren't repercussions. Remember, the very first noble truth is that all life is suffering. Suffering is the norm, not the exception. Many people living a Western lifestyle have been trained, more and more so through the media, that life should be happy and wonderful, and if it isn't, then something's wrong. This is very misleading, and not at all the way the world really works. Life is life. Sometimes it's wonderful, but that's just not a sustainable goal. All life is suffering. You can avoid it for a while, but not forever. Buddhists don't go to hell. They do, however, have to deal with karma and rebirth. Suicide causes a great deal of suffering, both to yourself and those left behind. Causing suffering brings on bad karma, lots of bad karma. And chances are that if you're suffering now, a bad rebirth will only make things worse. Now, it sounds awful to say that suffering is normal and that you should suck it up and move on. But that's really the only solution. Life is suffering. But there is an end to suffering, and that end is the Eightfold Path. Meditation can be a big help with combating depression, but medication and therapy can be just as much of a help as more Buddhist solutions. Just because we're Buddhist does not mean we cannot take advantage of modern medicine and treatments too. But as we all know, you have to make an effort to get better, and with depression that's not easy. Nothing is easy with depression. And then we spent 2 days covering a couple of interesting characters. We just now talked about Buddhist idea of hell, that there isn't one. That's not completely true, there is. When we talk about Yama and Naraka, we see that point of view. Yama is the personification of death, or in the more religious versions of Buddhism, as the god of the dead. He's usually depicted with a green or red skin and reigns over Naraka, the Buddhist version of hell. Naraka is hell for Buddhists. People go to Naraka due to bad karma as a result of their actions. Although they can stay there a long time, their time in hell is not permanent. In a way, Naraka may be more comparable to Christian ideas of purgatory than hell. But there are elements of both ideas here. There are also both hot and cold hells in Buddhism. So if you're ever reading about Naraka, you may see references to extreme hot or cold places. And we have a picture of Yama on the website, dailybuddhism.com/archives/91. Another interesting character that we've briefly discussed in the past is Mara. Last week, we talked about the four Maras that Buddha had to overcome. Those Maras were symbolic representations of hindrances on his path to nirvana. However, quite often Mara is portrayed as the physical manifestation of temptation. Much like Yama is sometimes considered the god of death, Mara is something like the god of temptation. Probably the Buddhist equivalent of the Christian Satan. While Siddhartha Gautama, Buddha before his enlightenment, sat beneath the Bodhi tree, Mara came to him with many temptations. He tried repeatedly to tempt Buddha to return to his wife and son, becoming a great king in the process. Failing in this, Mara hurled lightning bolts at him, but the lightning turned into harmless flowers before they ever got near Buddha. The thunderbolts turned into soft music in Buddha's ears. Even today, Mara is said to tempt men's souls, and is the lord of pleasures of the senses and delights in confusing and misleading people. Then, after talking about a couple of his characters, Yama and Mara, we moved on to talk about places throughout India, Asia, those places. You find many stupas. What is a stupa? Well, scattered across Asia are tens of thousands of stupas. Stupas are dome-shaped structures of varying sizes that are usually said to contain some relic of Buddha. Some are as simple as a mound of mud, while others are elaborate and ornate buildings. Most are some form of stone statuary or monument. When Buddha died, his remains were cremated and divided among 8 of his most advanced students, who buried them as stupas. Hundreds of years later, the Emperor Ashoka, who we will discuss some other time, had several thousand new stupas built, and supposedly split up the ashes from the original 8 stupas among all the new ones. Today, they can be found everywhere in the East, and during my recent stay in Japan, I saw dozens of them in all levels of detail. They're everywhere. As stated above, a stupa can be a single pile of mud, but generally there are 5 parts to one. A square base, a hemispheric dome, a spire, a crescent moon, and a circular disc. Then there's a quote from Guhyasamaja root text. A stupa is a place where all the Buddhists are abiding. Those beings who don't have the karma actually to see Buddha need the holy objects of body, speech, and mind. Statues, scriptures, stupas, as a field for accumulating merit. And then on another day, our emails turn to bodhisattvas. Now, we all know Buddha achieved his enlightenment and reached nirvana, but many others have done it as well. Then what? Well, no one knows, and we can only speculate on what really happens when a being reaches nirvana and leaves the cycle of rebirth. However, what happens if a person achieves enlightenment and chooses not to exit the rebirth cycle? This is what the bodhisattvas have done. Simply put, a bodhisattva is a person who has achieved perfect enlightenment, but rather than leave the cycle of rebirth, has chosen to remain behind and help others reach that goal. In a way, it's the ultimate form of self-sacrifice. They've given up their great reward to help others. Some groups also expand the definition of bodhisattva to include people who are still seeking enlightenment, but make great efforts to help others. Obviously, the second expanded definition includes many more people. People who choose to can take the bodhisattva vows. These vows are different for each sect of Buddhism, but the vows for the Zen sect go like this. I vow to liberate all beings without number. I vow to uproot endless blind passions. I vow to penetrate Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to attain the way of the Buddha. Now you hear those phrases, without number, endless, beyond measure. These sound very hyperbole, but they mean it. Remember, by giving up on leaving the cycle of rebirth, they have unlimited lifetimes to accomplish their goal. What is their goal? To help every living thing in the world achieve enlightenment and to eliminate all suffering. It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it. Next, a reader wrote in asking me to explain the Buddhist perspective on creation and evolution. That's certainly a controversial subject. You hear about it in the news all the time. But not so much with Buddhism. Well, creation occurs repeatedly throughout time in cycles. In the beginning of each cycle, land forms in darkness on the surface of the water. Beings who populated the universe in the previous cycle are reborn. Some of them become the new humans in the new universe. Suffering and misery reigns, and that's where we stand today. Eventually, the universe breaks down. All living creatures return to the soul life, and the cycle repeats. This is essentially the same as the scientific Big Bang and Big Crunch theory, only it integrates the ideas of reincarnation and karma. And this is again a remnant of Buddhism's basis in Hinduism. Although there are minor differences in some of the details, most Buddhists believe in these essential ideas or something pretty close. There is no creator god. There is no creation in the usual Christian-like way of looking at it. Some older Buddhist stories do indeed involve some kind of god or gods making the creation happen. But today, these are generally accepted as symbolic stories or allegories for the more scientific Big Bang theory that we've already talked about. And for the same reasons, most Buddhists also accept the theory of evolution. Simple life forms evolved and changed until the creatures we know today exist. In the past, we've talked about how Buddhists have a reputation for being logical, rational, and clear thinkers. And this is one of the reasons why. Most Buddhists will accept scientific thought over Buddhist myths whenever there are conflicting ideas or theories. And that leads me right into our next topic, which is a book review. And this is The Universe in a Single Atom by the Dalai Lama. Several blog posters and readers had mentioned this book a while back, and it served as a reminder to me that I'd never actually read the book. I know I've read excerpts of it before, but never gone through the whole thing. So it was time to get with it and read that book. For this one, I chose to go with the audiobook version, which was read by Richard Gere. I've seen interviews with the Dalai Lama talking with scientists in the past, and he always seemed pretty well informed. This book showed me that he's really on top of modern scientific thought. The introduction and first chapter were basically biographical, as the Dalai Lama explained his early scientific education, or lack thereof, and his growing realization that science was a necessity for future survival. He explains that when modern science contradicts something that traditional Buddhism has always stated, he's not afraid to adjust his old ways of thinking to accept the scientific viewpoint. There's a lot of discussion, especially in the early chapters, about quantum physics. There's a lot of technical explanation here, and the section's a little hard to follow at times. But suffice it to say, the Dalai Lama ties quantum physics in with Buddhist teachings. We are all one. There is no single self. It's complicated stuff, but it all makes sense metaphysically and physically. In the chapter on the Big Bang and evolution, he quickly comes to the conclusion that Buddhists and other religions need to revise their thinking when it comes to the creation myths. But we just talked about that. And I do have to admit that the book does drag in some places and gets a little technical in others. If your complete knowledge of Buddhism is from The Daily Buddhism here, then I suspect this book may be a little confusing in places. He discusses dozens of ancient Buddhist teachers with crazy, long-sounding names and concepts that we haven't covered here yet. On the other hand, if you want to stretch a little or have a more advanced knowledge, this book doesn't contain anything too painful. I think the primary benefit of this book is to show how well Buddhism meshes with modern scientific thought, and perhaps more importantly, shows how Buddhism is willing to bend when things don't mesh so well. And we have some links on the website if you're interested in buying the book, Universe in a Single Atom by the Dalai Lama. Okay, we started this podcast with a story, so now we're going to go out with another one. Zen Koan, called Is That So? The Zen master, Hakuin, was praised by his neighbors as one living a pure life. A beautiful Japanese girl, whose parents own a food store, lived near him. Suddenly, without any warning, her parents discovered that she was with child. This made her parents angry. She wouldn't confess who the man was, but after much harassment, at last named Hakuin. In great anger, the parents went to the master. "Is that so?" was all he would say. After the child was born, it was brought to Hakuin. By this time, he had lost his reputation, which did not trouble him, but he took very good care of the child. He obtained milk from his neighbors and everything else he needed. A year later, the girl mother could stand it no longer. She told her parents the truth. The real father of the child was a young man who worked in the fish market. The mother and father of the girl at once went to Hakuin to ask forgiveness, to apologize at length, and to get the child back. Hakuin was willing. In yielding the child, all he said was, "Is that so?" And that just about covers it for this episode of The Daily Buddhism. Remember, if you have any questions or suggestions or calls for explanations of anything before we get into more advanced material, send me an email at dailybuddhism@gmail.com. Also, I have another question for you. Do you prefer this every week or every other week podcast, or would you prefer something very short every day? Drop me a note, let me know. Until then, see you next time.